there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical debate, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your phone calls and emails. Welcome. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Got some interesting news, some stuff about stem cells coming up, lots of emails. I wanted to jump out right away with a story about grape seed extract and cancer cells. This was in head and neck cancer cells that were being grown in vitro. So it's important that we realize that this is a food supplement that is commonly used for its antioxidant properties. The extrapolation mainly has to do with the concentration. So I think this is sound research, even though it's still, as I say, in glass, in vitro, not in vivo in animals. In vitro is Latin for in glass. So in the recent journal Carcinogenesis, grape seed extract has been shown to kill head and neck cancer cells. That's squamous cell carcinoma, a cancer that's on the rise. I have another related story about that. The issue here is that this is a relatively low cost thing for people to get. It works by actually creating more reactive oxygen species in the cancer cell's DNA, and it stops the pathways that allow DNA repair, again, only in the cancer cells. It turns out that cancer cells, at least this type of cancer, have a lot of defective repair pathways. It's part of what makes them hard to treat because the cancers keep mutating in the face of therapy. But it also gives you a chance to target them in their vulnerabilities. And healthy cells have a lot of redundant systems for dealing with reactive oxygen species and other repair mechanisms. Now, one of the repair molecules that grape seed extract targets is BRCA1, BRCA1, which we have all heard about in reference to breast cancer. So I hope that they will be extending the research to look at the breast cancer cells of people who have BRCA mutations. It may be that a simple compound readily available at your health food store could have a huge effect on cancers. And for now, based just on this data, I think it's reasonable if you've experienced a squamous cell carcinoma of the head or neck, particularly an oral carcinoma, that maybe you should add a grape seed extract supplement in the spirit of can't hurt, might help. Okay, and there are stories about stem cells. I promised you two this week. First one about macular degeneration. Scientists have used human embryonic stem cells, and they injected a very small number of cells, only 50,000 cells, into the retina of two patients with macular degeneration. One had age-related dry macular degeneration, and the other patient was a woman with Stargardt's macular dystrophy. Both women were legally blind. With just the injection of these cells, the stem cells did take root and formed localized, healthy retinal cells. They did not proliferate inappropriately. They made themselves right at home, and the patients had striking improvements in vision. On the patient with the Stargardt's, she actually went from being able to not perceive the fingers on her hand held at arm's length to being able to count fingers held at the same distance. That's a significant improvement in a very disabling disease. The other patient went up from 21 to 33 letters on her visual acuity, and that's a pretty significant improvement as well. So stem cells are starting to be ready for prime time. And in a related study, not embryonic stem cells this time, but umbilical cord stem cells were used to treat brain damage. And the company has done this in human subjects. So this is really important. The company is Geron Pharmaceuticals. The embryonic stem cells have been shown to differentiate into glial cells, the very important stem cells turning into neurologic cells with just being put into the brain. So in other words, they pick up on the local trophic factors which are present in the tissue, and they don't require any special work to do that. the cells were able to transform into oligodendrocytes, which are insulating cells. They're the ones that make the myelin. And the myelin, that's huge because multiple sclerosis is a disease specifically caused by cells, immune cells attacking myelin. So if we can regrow myelin with umbilical stem cells, this would be a huge breakthrough. And it looks like it's extremely promising. This is not a therapy you can go out and buy this year, but 2 years from now, it wouldn't surprise me. They're doing human studies. There's certainly a huge market potentially, and that tends to drive research rather well, rather quickly. And it's still true, as the space program taught us, that if you throw enough money and enough brains at a problem, you can usually solve it. HIV therapy would be another example of that. Let's go to our first caller, and that is Bob in Santa Cruz.
All righty. Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hi. I have been diagnosed with Hashimoto's disease, and I've been looking at the use of low-dose naltrexone, and I just wonder what your thoughts are on that. And just in general, the use of it.
Okay. First of all, low-dose naltrexone is widely used for autoimmune disease. A lot of people don't know that. It's an alternative medical therapy. Naltrexone at higher doses, say 50 milligrams or so, is an opiate antagonist, and we use it for reversing morphine overdose or heroin overdose, and also it can be used as a therapy for alcoholism, although it hasn't taken great traction in that area. It does seem in some studies to help with abstinence. So that's the low-dose naltrexone piece. It is an immune suppressant, so you might want to stop it if you get a infection, while you're fighting off the infection at least. So I'll put that caution out there. And I am unaware of any scientific evidence that it's dangerous at small doses. And like I said, we do use large doses that's been approved for long-term use in humans. So the studies were done to validate it. I tend to have the feeling that, barring the infection caveat, it would be reasonable to generalize this to all autoimmune diseases. Hashimoto's thyroiditis is an autoimmune attack on the thyroid. Another couple of things I would recommend on that would be certainly get yourself tested for gluten sensitivity, because many people who develop this are actually getting some push to the immune system from being gluten sensitive, and that revs up their immune system. And in fact, there is some resemblance between the antigen gliadin, which comes from wheat gluten, and the surface of the thyroid. So people can actually get molecular mimicry triggering the initial attack on the thyroid. Another thing that's helpful for people with thyroiditis is iodine in moderate doses. This is very alternative. It's not standard of care medicine. I happen to think that the evidence is convincing that we're all a little bit iodine deficient relative to what would be the healthiest level in our blood. So I think a dose of 3 to 5 milligrams of iodine is generally safe and can be helpful at avoiding progression of autoimmune thyroid disease.
So would you find it helpful then to use the low-dose naltrexone in this condition?
Well, I can't give you specific medical advice over the radio, so I can only speak in generalities.
Right.
If a person came to my office and I found that they had no other contraindications or problems that would alarm me, and they asked about it, I might have them try it. You can track antibodies. The nice thing about this one, unlike multiple sclerosis, is that it tends to be a progressive disease. It doesn't relapse and remit. So you can do antibody levels, take the agent, and then check your antibody levels a couple of months later and see if they've dropped or heading in the direction of normal.
Okay. Now, does this disease also attack other parts of the body besides the thyroid, or is it just solely the thyroid?
Well, by definition, Hashimoto's is solely a thyroid disease. We see autoimmune diseases running in clusters, so you could very well have something else in your body that could also be autoimmune, so you might want to be checked for other antibodies, but I would definitely get the checks for the gliadin, so at least tissue transglutaminase tests and a anti-gliadin test would be worthwhile. Okay.
And is that something that one of the standard like LabCorp labs
yes.
can do?
Yes, it is.
Oh, okay.
All right. Good luck to you, Bob.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. I'm going to take a moment and read an email. This from Jane in Denver, Colorado. I'm 61 and over the last 3 years have experienced a great deal of short-term memory loss. I've been tested thoroughly, an all-day memory testing session with a neurologist at Denver Health, test reviewed by a psychologist, who also sees, quote, no cognitive impairment. I'm concerned this is early Alzheimer's, but apparently it doesn't fit any patterns the doctors are familiar with. That's correct, Jane, it doesn't. A suggestion is to memory retest at 18 months and also to consider Ritalin to address the distracting symptoms I'm experiencing. The first symptom I recognized was while collating copies about 3 years ago for real estate closings, I got confused on which stack of papers went where. Since then, it's continued to get worse and has come to affect my work badly. I lose my train of thought in everyday living. When doing ordinary tasks, I truly do whatever's in front of me and get 4 to 5 things going at the same time, forgetting each one as I see something else I need to do, then moving to another room and getting lost in the next project. When my boyfriend talks on a topic, I will often lose track of who he's talking about and then make a game of trying to figure out who he's talking about without asking since I've forgotten. Essentially, what Jane's experiencing isn't truly memory, it's a focus issue. It's almost as if she's developed ADD. She doesn't mention whether she's had any scanning done, but I would assume if they've spent a day doing memory testing, she probably also had an MRI or a CT scan. I think that it would be very worthwhile in a 61-year-old woman to consider trying hormone replacement therapy, specifically estrogen, if indeed she is without contraindications like a past medical history of breast cancer. And I would also advocate use of ADD drugs on a trial basis, again, assuming no contraindications, because what she's describing is much more ADD than memory. And I think that she's seeing it as not being able to remember what she's doing, but actually she's become highly distractible. I do hope that this isn't going to progress for you, and those are the two things I think I would recommend trying first to see if you can help this. I don't think this is just memory. Another email, this from Bruce. Thank you, Bruce in Elkhorn. He's frequently sending me emails, and some of them are quite interesting. This one I think is very fun. It was published in Current Biology, Volume 21, and I'll tweet a reference to this. By the way, speaking of tweeting and Facebook, if you go to AskDrDon.com and click on those icons, you can add my tweets, and I usually will comment and put references out on the content of each week's show. So if you're interested in following up, that would be an easy way to do it. Now, this research was looking at the brain structures based on some earlier research that had showed that the more liberal you are politically versus liberal versus conservatives, there seem to be differences in the way your brain works in terms of the amount of activity in an area called the anterior cingulate cortex. Conservatives have less activity when their brains are examined, and this is functional. So this is functional MRI looking at glucose and how fast the brain is metabolizing and in what areas. So your anterior cingulate cortex is also extremely important for suppressing pain. And when we do acupuncture on people, we increase the activity of the anterior cingulate cortex. I'm wondering if that acupuncture mellowing out safety feeling that people get could have something to do with this. Anyway, this is further research where they did structural MRI. And what they found is the more liberal you are, the larger amount of gray matter you have in the same structure, the anterior cingulate cortex. And a surprise finding, the more conservative you are, the higher the volume in your right amygdala. Amygdala is related to fight or flight. So maybe it's just about, do you feel safe? And if you don't, you're conservative. I'm sure that's highly simplistic, but it would be an interesting way to think about it. And I hope that the research will be followed up thoroughly. Let's go to John in Watsonville. Hello, John.
Hi.
Hi.
Here I am. My question is about infectious mononucleosis. Our godson is a 21-year-old, very physically fit college senior. In late December, on a backpacking trip into the Grand Canyon, he became ill and was diagnosed with infectious mononucleosis.
He shared the wrong water bottle, I'm betting.
Given that the gestation period might be 6 weeks, he might have shared it during Thanksgiving. But
that's
right now,
possible.
I'm curious about what to do about an opportunity that's come up.
Okay.
He flew home and spent most of the next 10 days on his back, sleeping and reading.
Mm-hmm.
But he has gone back to school and has allegedly confined his activities to classes, homework, and getting consistent sleep, which is, I say allegedly.
Yes, you did. Go ahead. What's the opportunity?
He's asked to go kayaking with us tomorrow in Monterey Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to provoke a relapse, but I also don't want to deprive him of some fresh air, sunshine, and moderate exercise. So I'm looking for another opinion about what the risks might be of not strenuous kayaking, but moderate exercise in a kayak.
I would tend to be giving a thumbs down and being conservative about returning to exercise with mononucleosis. You probably want to do this in a setting where you can stop the exercise right away and not overexert. And by definition, when you're out there on the ocean, things can happen. So he might have to overexert and provoke a relapse. Generally, I would have said about a week prior to this, an event like this, the nice thing to do would be go to the gym, get on, you know, treadmill, get your heart rate up for, you know, 10 minutes, you know, way below what you could normally do, and then see how you feel the next day. And if you tolerate light exercise, then you go to a heavier exercise. You've got to be careful with the cellular energy. Part of what mono is your mitochondria are sick, and they aren't producing energy properly. So you can get into oxygen debt and you have a crash. And this is very similar to the push-crash syndrome that is a hallmark of chronic fatigue. And many people start out with a viral mono-like illness, not necessarily mononucleosis, and then develop chronic fatigue. So I always worry about stressing the mitochondria, and I think you could easily get into a situation where you overdo. Maybe he could be in a larger boat and somebody else doing the rowing, but I really don't think he should be out by himself kayaking as the first exercise after mono.
Okay.
Okay. Sorry, but it's a beautiful day.
Sure is.
Certainly get some fresh air.
We might get a tandem and have him be the queen at the front of the bar.
I like that idea.
Okay, thanks so much for your advice.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Sean, and Sean's in Santa Cruz. Hello, Sean.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Very interesting show. I enjoy it thoroughly. I deliver bread, so I get a chance to listen to it pretty much every week.
Bread? Bread?
Yes. Bread's good stuff.
Bread is
good. Very popular.
Bread really is very good stuff.
Yeah, exactly. So with that said, your story about the stem cells is really interesting. I personally have, I think it's called, pronounced mybosis or mebosis. And basically, one of my eyes, the glands don't oil my eyes, so I've suffered in the sense of, I guess, my vision. What it looks like when I look into a light, you know, constantly, that eye. With that said, the stem cell research thing gives me hope in the sense that if my eye really did progress into something more, that, you know, there's some kind of hope as long as I have the cash.
Yeah, you don't have to consider that it's going to be Sean one eye in a couple of years. So that's
right.
Did you have any other comments or questions about stem cell research?
You know, I actually have to say also about the grapeseed extract. I wanted to make a comment about something that another caller called about. She was a vegan lady, and she was really interested in the fact that you could be vegan and be pregnant and not have a problem, etc. I believe, and my comment was about the salinity content of the womb is pretty much, if I'm not mistook, tandem with that of the ocean. It's the same.
It's very close. Essentially, if you take out the red blood cells and the white blood cells, we have seawater in our veins.
Right. And with that said, that stands to reason that somewhere in the past, we lived on, you know, fish, and that's what built our cell structures, etc. I mean, obviously, that I just think that that should be part of the diet, if anything, just because of that very notion that the salinity content is pretty much the same as the ocean and fish.
Well, it's an interesting hypothesis. I have to disagree with your reasoning a little bit.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I would think that since I'm pretty convinced that evolution is an established scientific fact and not a you know, not a hypothesis anymore. And then I think that we all started out in the ocean, possibly as sulfur bacteria. You know, sulfur bacteria is the current suspect because down at the bottom of the ocean, there's this heat and energy, and the bacteria don't need light. They live on sulfur. But wherever they started, the very first creatures were bacteria. And then the bacteria got together and formed, first of all, cells that are called eukaryotes that have nuclei. And of course, the algae get started about the same time as the bacteria, and they get chlorophyll so they can use the sun to make energy. So all of this is happening in the ocean. So the cells themselves are manifest and emerge and become, you know, one line of evolution takes us to fish. Then the fish develop legs, and then you have land creatures, and then eventually you have mammals, and then, you know, follow it down and
Priuses.
Get to us, and then it's a short hop to the Priuses, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, to me, nonetheless, that's very interesting what you say. And I think that, again, it shows the natural world with the grapeseed extract, you know, helping
yeah.
us. You know,
yeah.
That's well, interesting.
It is. And a lot of plants have hormones and chemicals that are identical to our hormones and chemicals. They use them for different purposes. They're signaling molecules, and you know, plants have a slightly different thing to signal about, but there's a lot of overlap. And a diet really should be primarily plant-based with, in my case, my diet is, you know, in terms of bulk, it's primarily plant-based with a lot of really nice, healthy, lean protein thrown in because I like protein. And as long as it's available, I'm going to eat it.
Right, that's right, you know, and I think that...
Well, I'm gonna sign off because we have a couple of other callers waiting. But thank you so much for calling, and please keep listening.
Okay, see you later.
Bye bye. And let's go to Leslie in Saratoga. Hello, Leslie. You're on the air.
Hi, Dr. Dawn.
Hi.
I just have a question about signing up for money because it's really hard to come by these days for being tested in MRIs as a subject.
If you are going to be in an MRI, the question to ask, first of all, is do you have any metal in your body and are you pregnant? Okay, I don't think that there's any evidence that there's damage to the fetus, but if your baby came out with a birth defect and you'd been in an MRI, especially for money, you'd never be able to shake the idea that you might somehow be responsible. So,
okay.
You know, just for in terms of, I don't think it's dangerous, but you'll be creeped out forever if that were to happen. And are they going to be injecting any kinds of contrast into you? Because a lot of times with MRI, they'll give you gadolinium, which is a contrast agent. It's a rare earth metal. It's not, so far as we know, dangerous. But I can tell you that it does accumulate in the body. When I do evoked testing for mercury and lead, metal, when I test for mercury and lead, I will see gadolinium. I could tell by the lab if the person's ever had an MRI. And this could be 10 years ago. So I know the gadolinium stays in our bodies. It's
okay,
probably okay.
There's no contrast. I'm too old to be pregnant. And I've done it for the last 3 months already. I'm just wondering if I can continue.
There's no known, and I mean literally no known adverse effect to multiple MRIs.
Okay.
So
I really like that womb feeling.
Interesting. Some people hate it.
It was really scary the first time, and then it just became so, not addictive, but I look forward to it. Of course, they try to keep you awake, but I keep falling asleep. The other thing is I don't know if you just learned about this, but there have been some mercury poisonings by women that bought this hand cream in Mexico with too much mercury. It was a bleaching agent.
Right.
And they've been putting it on their face for their spots, and they've got mercury poisoning. So I just brought that up as an aside.
Well, thank you. I'll look that up. I wasn't aware of that. And, of course, many products, the old days, they used lead as a skin whitener. So
lovely.
Yeah.
I heard borax. Anyway, the other question I had... So anyway, I'm enjoying this. You know, they pay $30 an hour, and I'm in it for an hour and a half. And it's from Omneuron, if you've ever heard of them. They're by Stanford, and they're just checking blood flow on healthy subjects versus drug addicts.
Okay.
And I'm a healthy subject.
Okay. Well, my producers just put a link up. he's just trolled the internet and found that there's a law office buying Google space, trying to put together a compensation for side effects after MRI with contrast. So,
this has not been, no contrast.
Right. Well, I think in that case, you're in good shape. And enjoy your $45 and your little journey to the womb. It sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
Okay.
The other question was Premarin.
Uh-huh.
I started it to help with the hot flashes. I was on it 3 months, and I've just taken a vacation from it to see if the hot flashes subsisted. Is that okay to do?
Yeah, I generally don't use Premarin anymore. I use bioidentical estrogens, but that's neither here nor there. Your best bet is to take yourself off it gradually, kind of sneak up on your system. And reducing caffeine and alcohol and stress will also help with hot flashes. But sometimes you just need to go to hormones. And when someone comes off of them, I will reduce them about 25% of the dose for a couple.
How do you do that when it's already a small pill?
Okay. You really want to just take a smaller dose. So if you've got a small pill, cut it in half.
Okay.
And then get a lower dose. I don't know what dose you're on, but then you can get a lower dose and cut that one in half and
try to taper
it down. Good luck, Leslie.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Okay. And we're going to Casey in Santa Cruz. Hello, Casey. Welcome to the show.
Howdy.
Hi.
I have a question about head and neck cancer that you had mentioned relative to grapeseed extract.
Yes.
And I know that, I've heard that there is a certain percentage of head and neck cancer that relates to human papillomavirus.
Actually, it may be a great deal of human head and neck cancer. That story came out this week in the LA Times. Well, actually, it was a study looking at HPV carriage in mouths, and they found 7% of teens. The group that had the most HPV was actually older. It was people in their early 60s. They had 11.4% HPV, and this is in their mouth. They just swished stuff and spit it out, and that the cells that came off the inside of their cheeks were tested. This is a brand new technology. So the reason we haven't known this before is that we haven't had cheap technology that allowed us to survey a large population. Head and neck cancers have been growing a lot in the last 25 years, even though smoking rates have declined. So the thinking now is that perhaps it's because HPV-16 likes the oral mucosa and somehow does the same thing it does for cervical cancer and anal cancer. It gets things going. This is a real plus for the vaccine industry because they've been trying to market Gardasil to boys, and it's been a tough sell because, you know, nobody wants to think that their son could be gay and otherwise, except in homosexual males, HPV really isn't going to give those males cancer, at least not very often. So this is interesting information. It's sort of in advance of what to do about it, you know, but probably if you consider at any given moment, roughly 10% of the adult population actually tests positive. And when you consider that people, you know, they'll clear the virus, and even once you've cleared the virus, that may not stop it from having damaged your DNA.
And so is grapeseed extract a worthwhile input just in general?
If you've had squamous cell carcinoma of the mouth or oral mucosa, just on the basis of this research, I'd start taking grapeseed extract. I mean, it's preliminary, but this is not a dangerous agent.
Are you looking at grapeseed extract as a liquid? You know, I go down, let's say, Whole Foods, and I get grapeseed oil. Is that a grapeseed extract, or am I looking at something else?
You know, I think that the research was done on actual grapeseed extract, and I am going to be posting the reference here online. So my thought would be, you know, in a couple of days, go to my Facebook page, Ask Dr. Dawn. Just go to my website, click on Follow Me on Facebook, and it'll jump you to that. And look for the reference, and then go look what grapeseed extract they used, and get that. Or get to however they describe it in the methods section. I wouldn't assume that just because you've got another product made of grapeseeds that's going to have the same active ingredient. You have to try.
Gosh, I feel like such an old fart. I don't have Facebook.
Oh well, it's going to get worse. But anyway, the reference then for you can listen to the show. It's in this week's journal Carcinogenesis, And the author is Agarwal, A-G-A-R-W-A-L. So with that information, the medical librarian at Dominican can find this for you. And I just want to comment, when I was talking about HPV and anal warts, I was not intending to insult anyone who's gay or homosexual. My comment was related to the fact that in the post-marketing analysis, one of the reasons cited for the difficulty in getting people to vaccinate male children is the resistance on the part of the parents of considering that their son could possibly be gay. And I wasn't stating my own opinion. If there are people who are prejudiced against people with dark skin, and you state that there are people who are prejudiced against people with dark skin, that is not advocacy of prejudice against people with dark skin. That is merely a statement that such opinions exist. And I can't emphasize enough that I had no intention of offending or insulting anyone regardless of their sexual orientation.
Okay, relative to something you told me, months back, I think it was, I was having some problems relative to digestion, and I was saying that every time I took this in that I would get a given symptom, and you said sometimes that, that links up relative to spinal nerves. And then it clicked that every time I went in my chiropractor, when I got adjusted, that symptom would tend to go away.
Bingo.
So I really appreciate that, because I've been going to my chiropractor, and that symptom has been kept at bay.
Excellent.
Thanks for that side note.
Thanks for the feedback, Casey. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye.
Quick story before we go back to the phones. This is big. They have found a way to target precancerous cells of the esophagus. We've talked a little bit about cervical cancer and squamous cell. Barrett's esophagus is a squamous condition of the esophagus, which normally does not have squamous cells on it. And when you develop a chronic irritation, you get squamous cells. The presence of squamous cells says that the damage is bad enough, you may actually be heading in the direction of esophageal cancer. But it's hard to detect these precancerous areas. And so in a cervical situation, we spray the cervix with vinegar. In fact, I did this just yesterday to identify white areas. Precancerous lesions and warts turn white on exposure to vinegar much faster than normal skin does, normal squamous cell skin. So it helps us act as a marker. What these researchers have done is they found a carbohydrate-binding wheat germ protein, and they hook it up to a fluorescent molecule, and then they spray the esophagus with it. Any dysplastic cells in the esophagus then light up under a black light, so the endoscopist can do a more directed biopsy, not just, you know, eyeball it and say, well, that's the most irritated area, so let's biopsy there. Instead, he or she will have the ability to target the most potentially dysplastic cells, and this will probably lead to fewer biopsies, because we'll come to trust that the absence of this fluorescent uptake indicates that biopsy is not required. So very happy to have new information out there for my endoscopy colleagues. It may take a while before this filters to the journals, but I think it'll be published pretty quickly. Let's go to the phones. Frank, you are on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
What's the pros and cons of using baking soda for an antacid? I take 20 milligrams of Prilosec in the morning and 300 milligrams of ranitidine at night, and still have to use 3 or 4 tablespoons of over-the-counter antacid during the daytime.
There's no problem with using it. The downside is duration. It's pretty short-lived, and so you have to keep using it. I'm intrigued that you're still having symptoms, and I would wonder if you at this point are having some bile reflux, which is just as irritating but not acid-related. And I'd also wonder whether or not you're having gastroparesis or retaining your stomach contents. I presume that you're doing all the right things, you know, no alcohol, no caffeine, sleep with the head of the bed upright, and that you don't have a hiatal hernia. Am I correct on my assumptions?
Yes, I've been tested.
Okay. Well, next thing I would do is ask your doctor about a promotility agent, maybe low-dose Reglan, or using hydrochloric acid or vinegar with your meals to try and get your stomach to empty more readily. Betaine hydrochloride doses 500 to maybe 1,500 milligrams at the time that you sit down to eat. I'm also a reflux sufferer, and I have found that that seems to be quite helpful for me. And you certainly could use the bicarbonate as an antacid, but if your symptoms are not due to acid, but rather due to bile, it won't help.
Okay.
Okay. But you can experiment with Reglan, which is a promotility agent. If that helps, then okay. You really could have bile coming up rather than acid.
Yes.
Okay.
Ask a real short question.
Yeah.
Whenever I start drinking coffee, regular coffee, I start, my heart, after about a month, will start skipping beats, and then it takes like a month after I stop to before it stops skipping beats.
Well, don't drink coffee then, decaf or otherwise.
It could be, it does cause it then.
Well, it's potentially causing it. You've re-challenged it several times and had it happen. I think it's certainly plausible there could be some other compound. There's theobromine. There's other trace xanthine things that could be cardiac stimulants.
With a tea or...
I don't know. You'll have to test it.
Okay.
You'll have to test it. You've got an individual body there, but it's pretty easy to experiment on this one.
Okay. Thank you so much for your help.
Thank you very much. Let's go to George in Watsonville. Hello, George. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I wanted to ask you some questions about genital herpes.
Okay. Go ahead.
I do not have genital herpes. And my girlfriend does, and she's been experiencing what I think is what's called the prodrome for the last month, where mm-hmm. she has tingling on her lip and in her genital area. But my experience previously is it doesn't usually last this long, and we wanted to know if there's something we could do to know definitively or if there might be some other cause of this prodrome type thing.
Well, usually what that is think about an arm wrestling contest, mm-hmm. and so... She's getting symptoms in the nerves that are infected with the virus, and it's not multiplying fast enough to get to the surface of the skin and cause lesions. She might still be shedding virus, which is important to understand. Some people shed virus without even having the prodrome. We know this because they've paid people. We had a lady earlier who was getting paid to do MRIs. Well, they've paid people to swab their genitals every day for 6 months and look at when they have herpes outbreaks. And what they found is that some people shed virus between outbreaks randomly with no symptoms. Typically, I would say that you could always postulate that there's something else causing it, but Occam's razor says the simplest answer is the most probable. So most probably the virus is trying to wake up and she's not being able to knock it totally back. Circumstances like this in my medical practice, I will put someone on constant dose of an anti-herpes drug for 3 to 6 months, suppressing the virus, and seems to induce remissions, at least temporary remissions, and the frequency of the prodrome. It also has been clearly shown to improve the viral shedding. In terms of being a serodifferent couple, it will help you not get this.
Okay. Typically, I think acyclovir used to be the most common one, but it had side effects.
Well, it's actually, I think it's a pretty safe drug. There is valacyclovir, acyclovir, and famcyclovir. The valacyclovir may have gone generic. The famcyclovir, I think, is still proprietary. In terms of years of using it, I haven't really seen a lot of side effects, particularly at the low doses you use for suppression. So the package insert's really scary because the package insert was done back in the 1980s, and that was set by the FDA then. But based on what we've learned in the last 30 years using it, we now give, for example, very high doses of acyclovir are given intravenously to newborn babies if they are potentially exposed to herpes as they come through the birth canal. And it doesn't hurt them. And they've grown up now. You know, they're now 15 and they don't have any increased frequency of learning disabilities or weirdness. So I think we can feel pretty comfortable with acyclovir.
Is there any interactions with, say, SSIs like Lexapro or something like that?
I'd have to check that on a computer off the top of my head. I couldn't say.
Okay. And then use of lysine.
Lysine is an amino acid that in alternative circles has the reputation of helping prevent herpes outbreaks. It competes with arginine for absorption. Arginine's important for your blood pressure. And so if a person's taking big doses of lysine to prevent the herpes, I generally recommend taking some supplemental arginine to avoid creating an amino acid imbalance.
Wow, okay.
Otherwise, I have people who swear by it, and I also have people who can't take arginine because it flares their herpes. So it's like there's definitely something going on there.
Okay. All right.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye. I'm going to read an email, this one from Meg Henschel in Watsonville. Re, a recent question you had about therapy for uterine fibroids. I just wanted to mention that hormonal contraception will control heavy bleeding. The progesterone-containing intrauterine device, Mirena, is nice for older women because for smokers, we might not want to put estrogen-containing methods like birth control pills in the system. The Depo-Provera injection is also good and will suppress the endometrium without the side effects of something like Lupron. As a woman's health practitioner for many years, I have found that hormonal contraception will control most women well on their fibroids until they can get through menopause, unless the fibroids are so large they're causing pain. All right, another voice heard from. Let's go to Susan in Santa Cruz. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hello. My question is about rotator cuffs.
Go ahead.
An MRI has shown that I have a massive tear in my rotator cuff, and the surgeon has said that if I have surgery, there's a 50% chance it'll be a bit better. So I'm kind of inclined not to have surgery.
Well,
I've done a lot of physical therapy. It doesn't bother me very much, but the main problem is I have very little strength in my arm. And so the surgeon told me if I use my other muscles to compensate, I'm probably going to get arthritis. I just wonder if you have any ideas of other things that I could be doing to, if it's possible to get strength back in that arm.
Well, I'm inferring that you probably have a tear in the supraspinatus tendon, which is the tendon that the muscle on top, yes, it's the tendon for the muscle on top of the scapula, the shoulder blade, and it is the one that lifts your arm when your arms are in front, and it lifts it up to chest height, basically. And then after that, other muscles take over, but it's in getting to the chest height that you're probably weak.
You know, it's getting overhead that's where I'm weak.
And then I think that maybe that you have a tear in a different part of the rotator cuff.
Okay.
You know, you may have something going on with the cartilage as well, that the lip of the cartilage, the labrum, can often be torn. But regardless of the specific location of your tear, there are a series of rehab exercises and stretches, and you're going to want to be doing those. The chances of being able to strengthen the arm without flaring the rotator cuff is where we get into difficulty, because as you start to load it, that tear gets inflamed, and then you start to have pain. And so it's kind of a vicious circle. If you're not disabled by what's going on, and you can find ways of compensating using your left arm, then I think that you should stay tight and not get surgery. If you really have functional difficulty that can't be compensated for, then I guess a 50% chance of improvement is better than nothing. I've seen a lot of people be just as bad after their surgery as before, and I'm just wondering where that 50% figure came from. I've never tried to quantify it, but it's certainly not a sure thing that operating will help.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Here's an interesting story about sort of surprising research. This was looking at cancer cells. These are people at Columbia University studying cancer cells, and they were checking to see, you know, various drugs that might help. There has been some epidemiologic evidence that taking statins helps with breast cancer. Statins are kind of getting a lot of interesting research coming out. It turns out that cancer cells that are P53 mutated respond to statins. And the researchers were studying cancer cells in a rather dynamic system, a 3D model of the human breast. And they were letting the cancer cells grow not just flat on a plate, but actually in this space so that they could track how they spread. What they found was that when they put statins into the growth media, cells with this mutant P53 gene just stopped growing and in some cases died. Now, researchers are looking at taking breast tissue from cancer patients and finding that indeed statins may be effective against breast cancer tissue in human women. So, an interesting side on the statin controversy. Sometimes we get a little surprised when we're doing research. I certainly found that surprising. Let's talk to Bruce. He has some comments about rotator cuff. Hello, Bruce. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Dunn. Very briefly, I've torn my rotator cuff 3 times, you think I learned, but it took me a while to understand the mechanism that it was really that I don't have much muscular strength, nor do normal humans above our arms. We really weren't designed for that. So anytime you're dealing with any kind of weight or stress that's above shoulder height, you don't have the musculature, and you can do special exercises with stretch bands to improve that. But, you know, when the woman mentioned she didn't have much strength above her, you know, over her head, well, that's normal for everybody. It's not all our strength is really from picking something up off the ground. We're not really designed to, you know, push things above our head, just in terms of our normal musculature. But I found with dealing with surgeons, because I've dealt with three surgeons and physical therapists, was like, the surgeons really didn't want to deal with me after the surgery. It was like, this is what we'll do, and then you're on your own. And the physical therapists were the ones that really helped me with the right kinds of exercises with the right type of equipment to strengthen my upper shoulder area and strengthen those tiny muscles so that they could resist future tearing and pull things back into alignment, which was part of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And our age of keyboards and such, we really sort of misalign our bodies, and part of it's the upper shoulders and the way everything, you know, has to hang together.
Right. We should be picking more fruit off of trees with overhanging branches.
But again, the help I got was from physical therapists. I mean, surgeons are not people to give advice on post-operative care. That's not their area.
That's not their orientation.
Experience, really.
Yeah. Well, they unfortunately also have no reimbursement for that. The way that Medicare sets up, and this is partly responsible for it, I might add, because surgeons are essentially capitated for the surgery. So there's this 30-day or 40-day period. I think it varies depending on the surgery, but it's usually 30 days. So you do the surgery, you get a global fee. That includes all of the follow-up or no follow-up. And nobody really pays attention to how well or how much time the surgeon spent on follow-up. So they've already gotten paid to do the surgery and largely consider that that payment was for the surgery and that they're doing the follow-up is kind of free. It's time out of their pocket, so to speak, and they're not getting any additional reimbursement. And this is, you know, capitation, effectively. When I'm in an HMO program, I receive a global fee every year to take care of patient X. And if patient X is an emotionally needy person who comes to my office every week with a different imaginary pain, and I have to due diligence evaluate them, I don't get paid any more money for doing all that extra work. I already got paid my retainer. Mentally, I totally relate to where the surgeons are coming from in the sense of, okay, really, you're just taking my time now and, you know, you'll get better. Go away.
Yeah, it's not so much the fault of the surgeon as to not expect them to be able to give you good advice because they really don't have that experience firsthand the way a physical therapist does.
Sure.
Of working with a person after surgery. And in general, I found when I've had something like the rotator cuff, you're better off going to a doctor that specializes in sports medicine because it's the person that's out there aggravating their thing playing tennis or sport is more likely to go to that doctor, and that doctor's going to have more first-hand experience with those kinds of injuries.
Very true. Thank you very much
for the call, Bruce.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. We've got time for one quick call with Kira. Hello, Kira. Well, from Monterey.
Hi.
What can I do for you today?
Well, I have a question. My roommate takes a lot of supplements that her mother sends her from Texas, and I want to find out if they seem to be, you know, helpful or whether they are bogus. And one of them has to do with colloidal silver.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Silver Shield.
Right.
And I'm just looking at the bottle now, and it's...
I'm familiar with it.
Okay.
So,
because my roommate never gets sick. She's always healthy. So I'm wondering, is this a product I should be taking?
Well, I don't advocate for the use of taking colloidal silver orally. I use it for disinfecting wounds. I use it for sterilizing the nasal passageways in a person who's got recurrent sinusitis. But I don't like to put it in the intestinal tract because it's toxic to your good bacteria as well as your bad bacteria. So that's something I would kind of shake my head at. In terms of do supplements help, that's been very hard to prove scientifically. But there are plenty of anecdotal reports of people saying, you know, when I stopped my vitamins, I started getting sick again. And when I got back on them, that stopped. Your friend may just be naturally healthy. I don't know. You can't really say. But it has to be looked at supplement by supplement. And in terms of your question about silver, no, I don't think that's something I would recommend for everyone to do.
Thank you. Do you have time to answer a question about the shingles vaccine? Just one quick question.
Very quickly.
Okay. The cost for it is like $240.
That's right.
And I don't believe Medicare pays for it.
Right.
How important is it to have it if you don't have $240?
It's not that important to have it if you are looking at basically, how shall we put this? You don't want to not eat because you bought your shingles vaccine. If you've got the discretionary income, it cuts your risk of getting shingles in half. It also maybe makes it less severe when you do get it. That's all the time we have for your call, Kira. Thank you very much. We've got just, literally a minute, and I wanted to put out an answer to David in Alaska. He wanted to know about checking blood pressure, cuff on the legs. You can use the pulse. If you're trying to figure out whether you have peripheral artery disease, find a pulse behind your ankle, and that's the inside part of your ankle, and then blow up the blood pressure cuff. And when the pulse disappears, keep blowing it up another 10 points, put the blood pressure cuff on your calf. Then as you let the pressure out, when you start to feel the pulse again, that's your number. That number should be 130% of the number in your arm. And if your blood pressure in your leg is less than the blood pressure in your arm, then you're definitely looking at peripheral artery disease. So let me just start my theme playing, because we've come to the end of another hour. I want to thank you so much for listening, calling in, writing your emails. Please go to that website and follow me on Twitter and Facebook. I'm putting a lot of time into that. I'd love to have an audience. And so long, and stay healthy.